The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We are very glad to have you with us here on KPCG. And you've got all the regular ways of listening online at kpcg.fm, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. We're very happy to be on CRN Digital Talk Radio on Channel 3 there. And of course, you can watch the video on the live stream, thetrumpet.com. But however you listen, we're very glad to have you. Our headquarters campus in Edmond. They're very busy now with the youth camp, the summer camp going on there. And there's a lot of people over there that are doing double duty, that are involved in camp, that are also helping keeping on ticking over all of the other things, the websites, the radio shows, all of those different aspects. But we're happy to help here from Edstone during the busy summer camp season. I'll also, seeing as I'm touching it by mistake, mention we got a big box of Trumpet Daily mugs over here in Edstone recently. They're sitting downstairs, so I don't know exactly the plan on that, but I imagine we'll be able to start selling some of these mugs to international customers or people over here in the UK as well. And they are very, very sturdy mugs. I think they feel like they would keep your tea warm for a good long time. Well, like the last few hosts, I want to start by giving you a bit of an update on vaccine passports. You've heard on that really in the last couple of shows, at least here. And it is shocking how quickly this story is moving. I mean, it's a pretty niche topic, vaccine passports, but there's literally something new on this every day. We had Mr. Stephen Flurry reading letters from listeners getting caught up with these vaccine passport laws, which is pretty shocking. You know, this is how common they've become now. People being told, you know, no jab, no job. If you want to continue a job, the government's saying you have to have a vaccine. And I think that was coming from the Oceania area. But we're starting to see this similar approach in the UK. There's a new law going through right now. I think Parliament's going to vote on it today, saying that if you want to work in a care home, or if you're working in a care home, you have to have the vaccine. Otherwise, you're going to lose your job. You know, this is Britain, supposedly the home of freedom. And we're saying, well, jab or else. And we had some pretty big developments on this story just yesterday. While Mr. Flurry was giving the show, Prime Minister Boris Johnson was giving a press conference, and he was supposedly announcing Britain's big unlocking, where all of our restrictions end this time next week, pretty much. I think July 19th is set to be Freedom Day. But here's what he said about vaccine passports.
And as a matter of social responsibility, we're urging nightclubs and other venues with large crowds to make use of the NHS COVID pass, which shows proof of vaccination, a recent negative test, or natural immunity as a means of entry. We're updating our guidance for the clinically extremely vulnerable on how they can keep themselves safe, and I generally urge everyone to keep thinking of others and to consider the risks.
So, you know, you've got to get the vaccine. You've got to, large organizations, you've got to accept vaccine passports. And, you know, it sounds very smooth. He's talking about, well, voluntarily, you know, it's a social responsibility. We are asking large venues to require vaccine passports. Really, though, there's much more to this than just, oh, we're just asking nicely. You know, there's been so much deceit on this whole issue all along that's just shocking. You know, just 6 months ago, the government officials were saying, you know, we'd never have a vaccine passport. We would never even think about introducing a vaccine passport. That's un-British. That's abhorrent. They even went as far as to say, no, we would never ask businesses to require vaccine passports. In fact, we're asking businesses not to require vaccine passports. Here's what the vaccine minister, Nadeem Zahawi, said. This is just in December of last year.
I think mandating vaccinations is discriminatory and completely wrong. And I, like the member for High Wycombe and others here, would urge businesses listening to this debate today not to even think about this. And I will explain in further detail why that is the wrong thing to do. I'm grateful, and I'll put on record my thanks to Professor Carol Sikora, who quoted me and said I eloquently dealt with the issue. He has many hundreds of thousands of followers, which I was very grateful for. So absolutely no plans for vaccine passports.
Absolutely no plans for vaccine passports, and businesses don't even think about requiring people to have a vaccine passport. We've come from there in just 6 months to the Prime Minister saying, you businesses, you need to have a vaccine passport, or if you're at least businesses with large groups of people, you need to have this COVID pass app and not let people in without it. And this app, you know, you can get a pass with a recent negative test. We'll talk more a little bit about that in a few minutes. Or if you can prove that you've had COVID, I think it is within the last 6 months. So I guess you could get around it by going out and deliberately getting COVID. But it's a stunning turnaround. And, you know, he was saying, we've got no plans to have a vaccine passport. The same month as he said that, the same month that that video came from, a consulting firm published a government-commissioned report on how vaccine passports could be used to keep unvaccinated people away from large events. So they were paying people to produce reports on how to have vaccine passports while saying, we have no plans on having vaccine passports. So we can't take what they say at face value. They have lied about this all along. And even now, they're at very least being disingenuous. You know, we're not requiring vaccine passports. We're just asking certain businesses to be socially responsible and for them to require them. But, you know, they're private businesses. They can do what they want. It's a free country, right? Well, that's not really what's happened here. This is a quote from the guidance that was published last night. So separate to the Prime Minister's press conference. And it says that this guidance is encouraging and supporting businesses and large events to use the NHS COVID pass in high-risk settings. And you know, I think we've all been familiar where high-risk these days means what we used to just call normal settings or everyday life. The government will work with organisations where people are likely to be in close proximity to others outside their household to encourage the use of this. So anywhere where you might be close to people that you don't live with, they want to start to require this COVID pass. If sufficient measures are not taken to limit infection, the government will consider mandating certification in certain venues at a later date. So they're actually telling businesses, do it voluntarily or we will force you to do it. So this is not just a voluntary social responsibility. This is more jab or else. That's what we're seeing again. And we'll still have to see more details on exactly how this plays out. Like I said, it was only announced yesterday evening. But businesses could very easily find themselves in a position where their insurance company says you have to require COVID passports. You've got to get a vaccine. You've got to require vaccine passports because the government recommends it. And if somebody claims that they got COVID at your business and they sue you and you were ignoring government recommendations, well, you could lose that court case. And so as your insurance company, we're only going to insure you if you require it. There's a real worry that that's how we could see this playing out. So basically, you can very easily see the government pretending it's optional. And already this idea of, well, it's optional, but if you don't do it, we'll make it mandatory. That is pretense. So they're pretending to make it optional while making it very hard to avoid. I think the other thing that's just remarkable about this story is how it keeps going away and coming back. You get this kind of rumor come out about vaccine passports to test the water. And then when the reaction is very negative, the government says, no, we would never do that ever. We would never even think about it. It's un-British. And then they come back a few months later and start to say, well, maybe we do this a little bit. You know, maybe just in care homes or just for big events. And then there's another backlash. And so then they step back and they scrap it and they say, okay, no, we wouldn't do that. And then a few weeks later, well, then it's back again. I mean, just a few weeks ago, the Daily Mail, on their front page, vaccine passport plan is dead. That's what they, that was their headline. Well, yesterday these plans were undead. It's just more cynical attempts at manipulation. You know, each time the plan comes back, people get a little more used to the idea. The outcry is a little more muted than before. More people start to say, well, maybe it's not a big deal if we have vaccine passports. If that's what gets us our freedom back, well, then maybe we can compromise. Maybe we can put up with this thing. And so it just keeps going away and coming back until we're used to the idea, until we're resigned to it. And we put a big focus on vaccines on our July 2021 cover issue. And that was there on the cover. Jab or else, I think, was the cover. Yes, there we go. We've got it up on our screen, or we should have it up on our screen pretty soon. Jab or else on the cover. And Mr. Stephen Fleury had an article in that on these vaccines. I had an article as well about vaccine passports and where they're leading. And we sent it to the press, and then this kind of vaccine passport issue started to go away. And it did kind of cross my mind, well, were we wrong? Was my article wrong to make such a big deal about vaccine passports? It does kind of look like it's going away now, and tons of people are getting the vaccine voluntarily. There's not so much talk about that in all their push to force absolutely everybody to get it, but especially in the UK, you look at the numbers that are getting it, and it's huge, the take-up, far bigger than they thought it was going to be. So I kind of, it crossed my mind at least, well, maybe governments are going to look at this and say, well, we've got enough people vaccinated. We don't need vaccine passports. People are getting the jab on their own. But then I thought about, well, just how deceitful the governments around the world have been on this very issue before. And it's clear that there is, there's clear that there's more than just, say, a rational desire to eliminate COVID or something like that in what they're pushing. There's a bit much bigger agenda here. And I thought, well, no, this will be back. When you tie that into Bible prophecy, and that just gives you absolute certainty. The Bible makes clear that we're heading in a more authoritarian direction around the world. So this is going to come back. And sure enough, here it is. We're seeing this back with a vengeance after it looked like it was going to go away. And there was news from France yesterday on this as well. It wasn't just Boris Johnson giving a big speech, Emmanuel Macron. He said, we must go towards vaccination of all French people. It is the only way towards a normal life. If you want a normal life, you have to be vaccinated, and all of France must be vaccinated. It was just like the Prime Minister over here. And it's just crossing my mind now. It's interesting it's the same day. I don't know whether they both coordinated this to have this big simultaneous push for vaccine passports. But he gave a televised address as well, and he was saying, well, these COVID-19 passports in France, they'll be required for anyone who wants to go to a restaurant or a shopping mall or to a hospital or to get on a train or a plane. You have to show your vaccine passport. And then, just like in the UK, to get this pass, well, you have to prove that you're fully vaccinated or that you've recently recovered from the virus or that you've got a fresh negative test. But I think one of the interesting things in France is it used to be free to get this negative test. Now it's not. You're going to have to pay a fee to get this negative test. So if you don't get the vaccine, if you choose not to get the vaccine, in France, every time you catch the train to work, every time you want to go to a restaurant, every time you want to go to a shopping mall, you will have to pay a fee to take one of these COVID tests. And I'm not sure how big the fee is, but you start to see how they're really upping the pressure. First, maybe it's a COVID pass that you can get the passport from having a negative test. And people might think, okay, well, I don't want the vaccine, but I can still get this pass with a negative test. So I guess that's not so bad. I can get a negative test, and that's not too much trouble, and I can still go out to restaurants and go out to all these things. So maybe it's not so bad, and I can put up with this. Well, then you see the next step in France. Okay, well, you've got to pay. You've got to pay every time. And I think it's, again, at least here in the UK, it's a couple of days that you've got to have the test form. It's got to be taken within the last few days. So you have to keep paying and keep paying. But then how long before, maybe what, still not enough people get the vaccine. So maybe they change the COVID pass again and say, well, actually, a negative test isn't enough. Or maybe they start ratcheting up the price. You know, once they've got this infrastructure in place, once they've got people to accept this, it's not going to be hard for them to keep pushing. And again, look at how deceitful they have been over the last 6 months on this. What are the odds of that deceit stopping and then being and everybody being completely above board and sincere and honest about what they're doing here? That's not going to happen. The Spectator had a really good article on Mr. Macron's speech. It says, there's no question that in practical terms, it will not only be compulsory, but it will be impossible to conduct a normal life without it. That's what this COVID pass is going to mean. You've got to have this to engage in normal life. And sure, the government says, well, you know, it's not compulsory. We're not forcing people to get the vaccine. But really they are. If anybody wants to engage in normal life, they have to have that vaccine. And that's exactly what I talked about in the COVID passports article in that Trumpet print. I just went through some of the different ways that right now governments were talking about implementing this in ways that would do exactly that. You know, there wouldn't be a law that says you go to jail if you don't get the vaccine, though who knows? I mean, we've already gone way further than it seemed like than I would have just said normally expected us to go. Who knows if that's coming? But for all intents and purposes, if you want to live a normal life, you've got to get this, they're saying. And just to go back to the Spectator piece, it says, this was undoubtedly the most authoritarian speech delivered by a French president in decades, but wrapped in a nakedly political pitch for 5 more years. We were promised a French version of Build Back Better, but only if we do as we are told, and only if Macron continues to be in charge. The most authoritarian speech delivered by a French president in decades. And I didn't have this in my notes, so I probably should have done, but Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, one of his first articles after COVID was really becoming big, was coronavirus in the Holy Roman Empire. And this is exactly what he said in that article. He wrote, I mean, we're talking about tomorrow's news today. This is from talking about the July issue. This was, I think, the July 2020 issue, there sometime in that summer that he wrote this article. And he was saying there, watch for coronavirus to make Europe more authoritarian. I'm paraphrasing, but that's almost exactly what he said. And now what do we see? The Spectator, this was the most authoritarian speech delivered by a French president in decades. Exactly what he said. And he said that because of Bible prophecy. Because the Bible tells us what direction Europe is heading in. It tells us that it's going to be a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, a resurrection of an authoritarian power we have seen before in Europe. The Bible talks about a power led by a church rising up 7 times, and we've seen a power led by a church rise up 6 times in Europe. It's going to happen one more time, and it's going to be led by kings. It's going to be led by strong leaders. And that whole article was saying that's what's happening, that's where this is going. And look at what you see in France. I'll just keep going with this Spectator article. It says, in September, for everyone over 12, vaccines are to be rolled out for middle school and high school pupils. And to mop up any resistance, health passports will be compulsory to get on buses or go to a restaurant. Reinforced frontier controls will be introduced. The police will be unleashed from September to enforce new rules. So in September, it's going to be even tougher. All this appears a prelude to a two-tier society in which liberty and equality is being jettisoned without much debate. The French might have the liberty to refuse the vaccines, but they will risk losing their jobs, forfeiting the right to travel, or buying food. Those with vaccine passports will certainly be more equal than those without. And this whole world is shifting to become more authoritarian because of COVID, because of the way politicians have chosen to respond to COVID. I mean, you heard the first-hand accounts from Mr. Fleury yesterday if you listened to that show. How long until we start getting these kind of accounts from Western nations, from Britain, from France, from Ireland? They're going down this route too. No, only those who are fully vaccinated go to a restaurant. What about maybe from New York? You know, again, I point out, it looks like vaccine passports are going away in America, and there certainly has been much more of a pushback against that than in these other countries. And maybe some of these southern governors will be able to keep this off. We've talked a lot about President Trump, and you could have this resurgence, and maybe that will end up seeing them through. But in the meantime, until that happens, we thought it looked like politicians were backing away from COVID passports in the UK. It looked like they were defeated in the UK, but no, they just brought that idea right back. Is that what's going to happen in the United States? It's certainly what the radical left and what some of those governors of northern states would like to. So are we going to see these stories from Andrew Cuomo soon? Which is the TV anchor and which is the governor? I forget. But is it going to come in? Are we going to get these first-hand accounts from New York? In the article from our July issue, I talked about, again, plans that the government were making that would force you to get a vaccine passport without necessarily making it mandatory on paper. And companies that the governments around the world were working with were boasting about all kinds of these dystopian-type plans, where you wouldn't be able to buy tickets unless you had this digital COVID pass and it would be all integrated. So if you try to buy a train ticket or a plane ticket, it would check your vaccine status. One company that the UK government is working with was boasting about how they could have the vaccine passport so that if you're going to a friend's house, you would have to scan your vaccine passport and your friend would have the ability to scan your passport and you could only get together with your friend if you had this passport. And they were boasting about implementing that. But here's what I wrote in that article. The result is the government knows where you are at every point of the day. It has a high level of surveillance and therefore control that until recently the Chinese communist regime could only dream of. A government record determines if you can work, travel, access entertainment, or gather with friends. Not even the Soviet Union was able to track its citizens' movement in real time. This is a bit further down. Such a system could be misused in many ways. And, just went to talk about once you've got this all set up, well, sure, we can block out the unvaccinated, but then you can block out other people the government wants to block out. What about those who hold opinions that the government doesn't like? What if those who believe that Donald Trump was cheated out of the election? What of those that sympathize with the January 6th insurrection? You could certainly see the United States government blocking those individuals out, saying, well, if that's what you believe, if you're on this list that we have, well, you shouldn't be able to have a job. You shouldn't be able to travel. You shouldn't be able to go to the shopping mall. You can certainly see how it could be expanded that way. And the infrastructure for vaccine passports won't do all of that. It won't complete that process. But it will do most of the heavy lifting. And crucially, it will break perhaps the first and the biggest barrier, citizens' resistance to surrendering their rights. So we're seeing a major step towards this kind of authoritarianism. That article is Where Are Vaccine Passports Leading? There's a sidebar in that as well called Is Coronavirus the Mark of the Beast? And that's something that has, I guess, come up in certain areas in some discussion. Could these vaccine passports be the mark of the beast? You need them to buy and to sell and to have a job. And that matches this description of the mark of the beast in the book of Revelation. And I've talked about that before on this show. And the short answer is, the Bible reveals very specifically what the mark of the beast is, and it's not a vaccine or it's not a vaccine passport. But at the same time, the Bible does prophesy that we're heading in a more authoritarian direction. And all of these rules and restrictions and these processes could well be used to enforce the mark of the beast. They could form a part of that, or at least they're part of the enforcement of that. Now, I think without what the Bible prophesies on this, you have quite a hard time believing it's even possible for nations like Britain and France to act this way. So those two articles, and then Mr. Stephen Flurry's article, the one with the jab or else headline, are great places to go to understand more about this, more about where this is leading, to put this in context of Bible prophecy. Because like I said, I think that's the only way you can understand why these leaders are pushing so much for this kind of a vaccine passport. There is a hidden agenda behind it, say, but it's a spiritual dimension that we have to understand and see here. So that Trumpet print edition will help you understand that and help you see where this is leading and how it ties in to what the Bible is saying. Wow, it was almost half the show. I didn't intend to talk quite that much, but it really is stunning how much this is changing the world. But you can get a subscription to the Trumpet magazine at our website, thetrumpet.com. We have our phone number you can call as well, 1-866-930-3023. 1-800-324. We'd be very happy to give you a free subscription to that. The magazine is always free and we don't sell your details or anything like that. We just want to get this truth out to the largest audience possible. We want you to understand this, what the Bible says about end time events, because understanding what the Bible says about these events is the only source of hope. It's the only way to know where this is leading and to have hope in the dark times that are coming, because it shows you that God is fundamentally in control of everything that is happening and it's all unfolding according to his plan. So you can get that at thetrumpet.com, as I said, or call that number 1-866-930-3024. Well, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about some headlines and we'll talk about some statues that aren't being torn down this time, but some statues that are being put up. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Breathing out, breathing in, more precious than it's ever been. We can't take it for granted. Never in our lifetimes has that fact been clearer, that precious breath of life. It might start to shorten. It might struggle. It might cease. How can it be protected? How can it be prolonged? How can it be saved? And what is the purpose anyway? What is the purpose of human life? What should you use that breath for? Most of us turn to doctors. It's a reflex, but it's becoming more and more clear that the medical industry does not have all the answers. It can be amazingly helpful, but can it actually heal? Is this the place to turn for healing after all? The human body, human breath, human life was designed, powered, preserved. It was created. Who made it? With something so important as your life, you need to know the creator of life. The Plain Truth About Healing by Herbert W. Armstrong will show you from your Bible the answers to the questions even most Christians are afraid to ask. Is the day of miracles past? Does the living God heal sickness? Did God raise up medical science for our day? What is the role of doctors? You can have not only sound health, but a sound mind. Go to thetrumpet.com and search The Plain Truth About Healing by Herbert W. Armstrong. The Trumpet Daily.
Oh, and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, here at thetrumpet.com or 101.3 on the FM dial in the Edmond, Oklahoma region, or on CRN Digital Talk Radio on CRN3. We're very happy to have you with us today. I thought I'd try and go through some headlines quickly. There is so much going on that I'm trying to do a quick fire round to get through some other important news stories. This was from Wall Street Journal yesterday. Governments worldwide gorge on record debt, testing new limits. This world is being gorged on debt, and they had some stunning different facts here. They talked about how global government debt is at the highest level now since World War II. We're up above the world's annual economic output. So now, if you put everything made and created by man over the course of a year anywhere in the world, goods and services, and you put the value of all of that towards paying off the global government debt, it would not be enough. And like I said, the highest level since World War II. We're now on this massive level of spending, really unprecedented in peacetime. And this article says advocates say the massive spending that we're seeing, it says that the spending is encouraged by new economic thinking about debt. So we've got some new economic thinking about debt. I think when Sam was on the show, he was talking about, I think, the scariest words in the Ronald Reagan talking about the scariest words being I'm from the government and I'm here to help. I think in economics, the scariest words are this time it's different. And we do this time and time again, where there are things that have definitely in the past caused catastrophe. And we somehow find a way to convince ourselves this time it's different. And that's exactly, you know, we've got new economic thinking this time. Yes, debt has been caused massive disasters economically in the past, but this time it's different. There's new thinking. And this time we can borrow our way to prosperity. But then this article says, if those theories are off base, the world could be saddled with debts that can be absorbed only by inflation, high taxes, or even default. Default meaning just the government saying, we're not going to pay our debts back. And that can lead to some pretty bad times. Either way, the combination of huge debt and the market's lack of concern is unprecedented. The U.S. government is on course for a budget deficit of $3 trillion for the second year in a row. Goes on to talk about worldwide government debt being 105% of global gross domestic product in 2020, up from 88% before the pandemic. I mean, if you have a hard time following the figures, don't worry about it, but they're just, that's huge. That is an absolutely massive jump in global debt. Worldwide government debt. Total government debt could rise by an additional $10 trillion this year to reach $92 trillion. These are hard numbers to wrap your minds around. I should have tried to come up with some way of visualizing $92 trillion. I don't think it's even possible. I think it was Richard Feynman who used to say that, you know, we talk about things being astronomical when they're huge, and actually we should talk about them being economical, because sometimes the numbers you get in economics are even bigger than all the stars and things like that. These are just vast, unimaginable figures. Surprisingly enough, though, countries are able just to keeping on borrowing. It points out, well, it says Greece's traumatic crisis, which nearly forced the country out of the Eurozone, seemed to highlight the risks of debt. Now even Greece is finding that it's possible to ratchet up debt thanks to low borrowing costs that the European Central Bank helps keep in check. We've got all these central bank policies around the world that are making debt dead easy. And, well, we all know what happened last time central bank policies made it dead easy for Greece to borrow tons of money that they then couldn't afford to pay back. But we're doing it again. We're doing it again because there's new economic thinking about debt. Another story related to that, the Bank of International Settlements in their annual report published in June 30th, it was an annual report on 2020. They concluded that record inflation was combining with unprecedented government spending to push the United States into a debt trap. And they warned that the cost of servicing American debt could exceed levels previously seen only in times of war. So it was talking about, well, you've got inflation is going up, and we heard from that from Mr. Andrew Loker on Thursday's show. And so the government is kind of stuck. They're in a trap now, because typically with inflation rising, they would raise interest rates, which tends to slow the economy down a bit and helps keep inflation back in line. But if they raise interest rates, they can't pay their own debt back. And the debt on the government debt will become unaffordable. And they could push themselves and other countries into bankruptcy. But Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he had an article in The Telegraph in June 9th talking about the borrowing that America is doing. And he writes, Deutsche Bank has come close to accusing the U.S. Federal Reserve of an economic crime. It said that America is causing a chain of distress around the world, and it called America's debt a time bomb. Other nations are getting pretty upset at what America's doing to the financial system. I mean, to themselves, yes. This is going to be probably more destructive to America than to anybody else. But these other countries, no, they're going to suffer from the fallout from this as well. Deutsche Bank's report says the most basic laws of economics, the ones that have stood the test of time over a millennium, have not been suspended. You know, Deutsche Bank knows this time it is not different. Germany knows this time it is not different. They know what's going to happen when people keep borrowing at this level. An explosive growth in debt financed largely by central banks is likely to lead to higher inflation. They said, we worry, this is Deutsche Bank, that the painful lessons of an inflationary past are being ignored by central bankers, either because they really believe that this time is different, or they have bought into a new paradigm that low interest rates are here to stay, or they're protecting their institutions by trying to hold back a political steamroller. So they're taking note of America's debt trap. And like I said, Mr. Loker, he talked about inflation at length on Thursday's show. And the point that he made was that so many of these economic problems get back to moral issues. And like I said, his focus was on an out of control inflation. And he talked about the moral issues behind why this is happening. You know, so much of this gets back to things like, you know, people don't want to work. They'd rather sit back at home and get these handouts from the government, where the government is just borrowing the money and giving it out. And that's just contributing to inflation. People have to raise wages and put up costs of goods, and you get this wage price spiral because nobody wants to work because they're getting government handouts. A whole lot of this gets back to moral issues. And Mr. Flurry made this point, Mr. Stephen Flurry, he had an article in the April 2018 Trumpet magazine, The King of Debt. And he had a subhead in there, something like, debt is a moral issue. There you go, you've got the picture there on the screen of America, of Uncle Sam as the king of debt. But it just seems almost comical in some ways reading this. Mr. Flurry writes, the United States is exploding its debt in a way never seen in history. And this was 2018, and it's absolutely right. At the same time, that explosion is pretty tiny compared to what we see now. I mean, we were rightly impressed and worried by the massive levels of debt that we saw 2 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. You know, these were massive numbers, but then they still keep getting bigger. It feels a bit like people being impressed by or surprised by, say, the blockbuster bombs developed during World War II, where one bomb could destroy an entire block, and thinking, wow, that's big, only to then be confronted with an atom bomb. And then we think, wow, that's big, and then we see the hydrogen bomb. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger, the amount of debt that we're borrowing. And we're just not paying any of it back. And he talked about how America had reached a new level of debt addiction, and I think we've surpassed that, all of our nations have now. But in that article, he writes, we're a nation focused on instant gratification, selfishness, and greed. This explains why the wealthiest nation in history is still borrowing astronomical amounts of money. If you want something you can't afford, you charge it to your credit card. If you want government benefits the nation can't afford, you vote for the politician who promises to borrow money to give you what you want. President Washington was deeply concerned about imposing a financial burden on the next generation, but who even considers what kind of burden we're placing on our future generations? Living according to the spiritual principle of giving produces prosperity. Borrowing is about getting for self, regardless of the consequences. God says in Acts chapter 20 and verse 35, it's more blessed to give than to receive. If you're giving, God says you'll be blessed. If you're living within your means, saving, managing, and preparing for the future and thinking about your children, then you will be blessed. Psalm 37 and verse 21 says, the wicked borrows and can't pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. As a nation, Mr. Flurry writes, we've dug ourselves into a pit which we will not escape purely because of selfishness and greed. And he goes on, he has much more in that article. But I do have to keep moving. I'll just talk about some other stories. The Wall Street Journal had another one from a couple of days ago. If war comes, will the US Navy be prepared? And this is about a new report published by Marine Lieutenant General Robert Schmidl and Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, both retired. And this article says that it paints a portrait of the Navy as an institution adrift. It says the impetus for this report was a series of recent catastrophes. A ship burning in San Diego last year, two destroyers colliding in the Pacific in 2017. Were these isolated events? And this report said many sailors found their leadership distracted, captive to bureaucratic excess, and rewarded for the successful execution of administrative functions rather than the core competencies of war. One recently retired senior enlisted leader said, I guarantee you every unit in the Navy is up to speed on their diversity training. I'm sorry that I can't say the same thing for their ship handling training. And it goes on to talk about a risk-averse culture on just this focus on being woke rather than ready for war. Just another area of decline. And we have America as the Navy is incredibly impressive in some ways. I remember doing a tour of San Diego Harbor, and the person giving the tour pointed to just one boat and said, that boat could take on a small country by itself and win. Just one boat, one ship. And you know, there are lots more than just one. But or being undermined by a lack of leadership, by this kind of feminized leadership and this focus on diversity training. I'll just skim through a couple of other. Well, I'll just mention one more. I'll skip through this one. This was from our own website, thetrumpet.com. A billion sea creatures cooked alive. Just another story here where you might have heard about the heat wave in Canada and the Pacific Northwest in the United States. And the temperatures have just reached levels that are so hot that a lot of the sea animals there can't survive. And this article says the stench of rotting clams, mussels, sea stars, sea snails, and other invertebrates engulf the Vancouver seaside. But what this article talks about is, you know, people, there's so many that try to point to these kind of things and say, well, it's climate change. But there's no plausible way that climate change can explain all of these different, diverse, different problems and environmental problems that we have. I mean, you get some of these environmental enthusiasts trying to blame COVID on climate change and all these kind of things, but that just doesn't fit the facts. Instead, the Bible gives a clear solution. You know, God talks about how he was going to send weather curses to promise his punish people, his people, if they disobey. This isn't Mother Nature punishing us. This is correction from God. And that's the only explanation for this diversity of floods and typhoons and plagues of mites in Australia and you know, volcanoes, all of these kind of things that we're seeing at the moment. And that book, we have a booklet, Why Natural Disasters, with the natural in quotes there, will explain this. But I wanted to come to spend a bit of time on one last story here. We've heard a lot, we've seen a lot about statues being torn down recently. We even saw the statue of Queen Elizabeth II and Queen Victoria torn down in Canada. But what about the statues that we've been putting up? And there's the woke, the radical left there. They've also been replacing statues too. It's not just about tearing them down, though it is mostly about tearing them down, to be fair. There's many more torn down than gone up. But here's one that they are putting up. And again, remember, if anyone has any flaws, they've got to go. You know, they could have been the greatest person in the world, but if their brother's, wife's, stepfather's second cousin once inherited a slave, well, their statue has to be torn down. We cannot tolerate that kind of evil. Doesn't matter what else they've done, for that crime, their statue has to go. So what perfect people do get their statues put up? Well, one such person is John Chilimbwe. His statue has been selected to go up next to Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square. So this isn't off in some corner somewhere. This is literally the heart of London. On the fourth plinth in there. It will go up there for I think, a year or two. And so this is the statue under London Mayor Sadiq Khan. Donald Trump has had some interesting things to say about him over the years. You know, he's selected, or his process has selected this individual, the statue, to go up. So this is the type of person the left wants to celebrate. So let's look at him. Here's the artist, Samson Kambalu, being interviewed for Euronews about his statue.
So this is a sculpture in two parts. There are two figures. One is life size compared to other sculptures on Trafalgar Square, and the other figure is larger than life size. You know, and there are figures basically of John Chole, British missionary, and the larger figure is a Baptist. Malawian Baptist preacher and Pan-Africanist John Chilembwe, who was killed during an uprising in 1915. When I studied this photograph, there was emphasis on the hat, in that John Chilembwe is wearing the hat like this, you know, to emphasize, to make it much more, you know.
Much larger.
At the time, it was forbidden for Africans to wear hats before white people. And this is one part of the reasons why he was killed. He was protesting against such injustices against black people. So yeah, that the sculpture put emphasis on these hats. Yeah.
So he was killed for protesting against injustices and you know, things like this humiliating ruling about hats. That's what the author says, or the person that made the statue. But who is this person that they lionize? Well, There is a whole lot that the artist left out of that interview talking about John Chilumbwe's background. I mean, to be blunt, he was a racist terrorist, this individual that they're now putting up right in the heart of London. I mean, what he did absolutely meets the standard definition of terrorism, violence against civilians for political aims. It talks about him being kind of being killed in a protest because he didn't want to wear, or because of this unfair and like a humiliating rule about hats. Sounds like that's the impression that he gave you. He stood up for his rights. He refused to take off his hat. He was killed for it. That is not what happened at all. He sent his followers on a mission to, quote, kill all European men. And one man they found was William Livingston. He owned a local plantation. They decapitated him in front of his wife and his children. And then the next week, Chilumbwe preached a sermon where Livingston's head was next to him on a pole. I mean, that sounds like ISIS. That's something the Islamic State does. They burned down a missionary building because it was set up by white people, but an African girl died in that fire. And Chilumbwe was killed while on the run after this. You know, he wanted to start an uprising, but he didn't get the support that he thought he was going to get, and he went on the run. We'll tear down Queen Victoria. I think I saw a statue where people were attacking the statue of Picton. You know, they'll attack these statues of great individuals, but this is the person that they say they need to put up. Now, you could say that there are some extenuating circumstances here. The guy that he killed was pretty cruel. But that's not the point. I mean, killing somebody that's cruel is certainly not the right thing to do anyway. But if we hold him up to the same standards as the others, well, his statue has to come down. Do you think we're going to see protesters graffitiing his statue once that gets put up? It's getting put up in 2022. They just decided it. They're going to have protesters tearing his statue down, do you think? Because of what he did? No, but you know, this story, it really does expose the agenda behind this whole statue tearing down episode. You know, I wrote an article about this as well about a year ago on the real reason these statues were being toppled. And, well, I wrote, if you believe the Bible, you must accept the existence of an evil spirit being who hates God's plan, who hates what God is doing through Israel. This spirit works through human beings to blot out the name of Israel. He wants to wipe it out so thoroughly the name isn't even mentioned. And as Herbert W. Armstrong explains in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, the Bible has these massive promised to Israel. And if you believe the Bible, these promises have to be fulfilled somewhere. And Israel, a country in the Middle East, what they have is not sufficient to fulfill all of these promises of many nations. And things like that, and the most powerful nations on earth that were promised to the descendants of Israel in Genesis. They've been fulfilled, those promises were fulfilled in Britain and America. And that's the reason for this hate, you know, the hatred against Britain and America and all of these people that were involved in the fulfillment of these promises shows you that even. This is Satan's hatred for God's plan that involves Israel attacking these statues. You know, Mr. Armstrong talked about that book being one of the greatest proofs of a living God. Those statues and that history is a signpost that points you to God. That's why there's this absolutely irrational level of hate for anybody that's connected with Britain and America's rise to greatness. You know, they'll try to blot out those people, but they'll raise up this guy. They'll praise Napoleon, who reinstituted slavery into the French Empire. That's fine. But they'll tear down these other ones. Well, I did, though, want to conclude. We've still got 5-6 minutes left. I did want to conclude on more of a positive note, though, than on this individual that is having his statue put up. To get the positive note, we can look at a statue that the left attacks periodically that stands there. We're talking about Trafalgar Square. Well, you know, right in the heart of Trafalgar Square is Nelson's Column, is where you have this monument to Horatio Nelson. And we've been covering Nelson here in Edstone for our book club. And so I thought I'd bring a little of that to you, I think quite a while ago, before we'd even come close to starting the book club, I talked about one of the things that made Nelson great on this show. I talked about his vision. The book that we've been reading in the book club, actually I've got that here, is Nelson, A Dream of Glory by John Sugden. And he does a great job of showing how he had this real strong vision of success. And that's what kept him going and drew him forwards. But I want to focus today on another closely related characteristic. And this was a characteristic that was on display very clearly early in Nelson's life during the Revolutionary War. He was ordered to go and join up a mission to go up the San Juan River in Nicaragua to kind of try and, because Britain was at war with Spain as part of the Revolutionary War. And the idea was this would cut Spanish American possessions in half. It would open up a British path from the Caribbean to the Pacific. Now, his job in this was just to transport soldiers from Jamaica, pick up a few more people in some different locations, and drop them off at the base of the river. That was it. That was his job. But he didn't stop there. Soon he was leading the expedition up the river, playing a key role in storming forts and helping relations with Indian allies, and just a major role in this. But it was just remarkable because none of this, he played such a huge role, but none of this was his job. Now, he wasn't going beyond, I guess, what he was supposed to do. He wouldn't get in trouble. He wasn't breaking orders for doing it. But at the same time, if he'd have just waited in his boat back at the mouth of the river instead of toiling in the jungle, no one would have reprimanded him. No one would have said, well, you know, why didn't you do more? His duty was complete the moment he got those soldiers there. It was just in his nature to get fully involved in whatever project he was working on, to put his all into making it to a success, to not just think, what do I have to do, but what can I do to make this a success? To not just look at, well, what's my duty, but what can I do? And even more surprisingly, he had some grave doubts as to whether this mission would succeed. And in fact, it did fail. And you know, he saw clearly, I think, the flaws in it. But to see the flaws in the plan, but then still, well, this is what I've been ordered to do, and just absolutely throw yourself into it, is remarkable. The book, it quotes the commander who was overall in charge of this, was beside himself with admiration for a young naval officer who exceeded his duty to share every tribulation. The boy who gratuitously negotiated with Indians, led the boats upriver, stormed a lookout post and reconnoitered the fort, was now erecting and fighting batteries. I want words to express the obligation I owe that gentleman. This is what the senior commander is writing about Nelson. He was the first on every service, whether by day or by night. And he didn't even have to be there. All entirely voluntary. But this, you know, he was a very young man at this point, but you see the start of a wholeheartedness that carried into everything that he did. And this reminded me of a scripture in Luke 17 and verse 10, which says, so likewise, when you have done all those things which you were commanded, you say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. And Mr. Armstrong talked about this verse in the Worldwide News. And he wrote, in other words, Jesus says, if we do all that is our duty, all that is required, we are still unprofitable servants. The profitable servant does more. He thinks about his job, his duty. He sees extra things that need to be done, and he does them even on extra time. He doesn't watch the clock. It's not only how many hours he puts in. He does what needs to be done, even if it takes many extra hours. He isn't thinking about how many hours he gets paid for, but the great job God has us to do and what falls within his jurisdiction, regardless if it takes extra hours without pay. And he doesn't try to take over the boss's job. And Nelson's heart was in this work. He believed in the cause. So he didn't think, what is my job, but what can I do to move this forwards? And that attitude carried through and was one of the key things that went into making him great. And this is something we can all learn from. We can all implement this characteristic of looking at, well, not what is my job, but what can I do to move this forwards? Well, that's about all I have time for. Thank you very much for joining us today here on 101.3 on the FM dial, kpcg.fm, or at thetrumpet.com. You feel free to send us in any feedback, any comments. You can do that by emailing td@thetrumpet.com.